Welcome back to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, June 15th, 2011. I almost said 2007. That almost came out of my mouth. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
And we're here from 2007. We just jumped in a future machine. What did you people do? No, actually, this is entirely predictable from 2007, and plenty of people did predict this mess from 2007. Let's see, a few of the things we have covered in the past. We don't need to go back to voting again, but I did want to mention one thing about voting. I want to, in case someone listened to our podcasts, what do we do, about 30 podcasts on voting?
Something like that.
Or maybe three?
They were all like 6 hours long, yeah. I'm pretty sure.
But if somebody heard the podcast on voting and they're like, hey, you know, I really think I should vote. I don't agree on that. Hey, vote.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not like you have to have your libertarian card stamped by us to be a true libertarian. If you feel to vote, vote. And especially, in my opinion, especially if it's small elections where you can have an effect, then jump out there and vote.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, Kai sees it as an act of immorality, and the fact that I see it as counterproductive to the destruction of the state means nothing. If you feel that you should vote, then go vote, because really and truly the core of the libertarian concept is that your opinion may be right or may be wrong, but you're entitled to it, and you're entitled to act upon it as long as you don't, you know, harm anybody else or enforce yourself upon anybody else.
Yep.
And so the same with us. You know, this is just our opinion. And if you feel like voting, man, get out there and vote. If you feel like supporting Ron Paul or whoever your favorite candidate is, get out there and, you know, volunteer or send them money.
Or anything else you want to do. You know, hand out flyers, petitions. Try to get legislature on ballots, hand out pamphlets about jury nullification, any of that sort of stuff. If that's what you feel is correct for you to do, then by all means go do it, you know?
Yeah, I do want to give a quick mention of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Is that what it's called? Fully Informed Jury Association. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, they're doing great stuff. They go to courthouses, they have all the pamphlets, and they have information, and they hand it out to potential jurists. And jurists who will stop and read this stuff and understand it very often realize that the judge lies to them. And judges do this. I have been in the jury situations where the judge absolutely lies and says, you as the jury are not judging the law, you're judging the facts of the case. And that's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, and this is throughout judicial history, not only in American judicial history, but in all the way back through English judicial history, the purpose of the jury was not only to judge the individual, but was judging the law itself.
Mm-hmm.
And if the law was not a just law, the jury had the right to throw it out of court.
Yep. And if you're not familiar with jury nullification and you're not sure what your rights are if you get called to be a juror, there are a lot of really great resources on the internet to read up about jury nullification. And if you do get called to be a juror, print out some of that information and take it with you.
Yeah.
You know, pass it out to your fellow
jurists.
Jurists.
Yeah. And if nothing else, you know, it's a good opportunity. You're going to be forced into this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, it's a form of slavery. They don't give you a choice. They come. If you don't do it, they will come and haul you away and slap you with a fine and put you in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're going to be forced into this anyway. It's kind of like what we're talking about with voting. At some point in time, we're going to be forced to vote.
Yep.
Well, when you're forced to vote, what are you going to do? You vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And when you see, like, North Korea, they have elections for the dear leader in North Korea.
Right.
And oddly enough, they have 100% turnout and 100% re-elect the dear leader.
Yep.
Well, of course, that's what you do. I mean, what are you going to do? Get killed over the stupid thing?
Mm-hmm.
So you just go and you vote for the dear leader, and you go back to your rice farm, and you hope you don't die this week.
Right.
And so when you're going to the jury to do jury duty, you're being forced anyway. Go ahead and download some of the stuff from from Fully Informed Jury, and we'll put a link on the webpage today. But you can just Google jury nullification or fully informed jury, yep, and just get that information and go into it knowing what your rights as a jurist are, because the judge is not going to tell you.
And if you do not want to be a jurist, a juror, I don't know, that's a weird word. I don't like that word. If you don't want to be on the jury, just casually mention jury nullification during your interview.
Yeah,
and
actually,
they'll get you out of there as quickly as possible.
Yeah, the prosecutor will definitely take you off the list.
Yeah.
They will get rid of you. So if you're going to actually use your jury nullification capabilities,
don't mention it.
Don't mention it until the time comes when you actually vote on the guilt or innocence of the party. And then lay it down.
Yep.
Otherwise, before that, they will yank you out of there, and you'll be sent off to the cornfield, so to speak.
Yep.
You ever see that episode of Twilight Zone where anything little boy
the
didn't
little
want?
The little boy, yeah.
Anything he didn't want got sent to the cornfield.
Yep.
Yeah, judges are like that.
And that I wanted to kind of segue from that because, you know, we were talking about the Fully Informed Jury Association. There are a lot of organizations like that within the whole liberty movement. You know, the people up in the Free State Project are doing great things. There's a lot of activists out there that are really kind of working really, really hard trying to get liberty, you know, liberty within our lifetime, as they say. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, you and I don't necessarily think that that's a goal that can be accomplished, but I certainly appreciate that they're trying,
yeah,
you know, that they're getting the word out there.
Well, and those things need to be done. Somebody needs to do it, and they fill that gap. You know, it's kind of like if you imagine a battlefield, and you imagine like an old battlefield, the way they used to fight in like World War One, where there's just opposing trenches, and it's just, mm-hmm, a meat grinder where wave after wave of soldiers gets shot and torn up. There are those of us in the liberty movement who have to be in those trenches and just have to charge directly into the machine guns, and that's our fate, you,
mm-hmm,
know. And some of us are not suited for that. Some of us are more suited for, you know, running the artillery back in the back. Some of us are the medics. You know, some of us are the people back home buying the war bonds.
Mm-hmm.
Wars don't happen. This is using the statist model to support our libertarian and anarcho-capitalist views. But a state doesn't happen without a war doesn't happen without funding. And one of the major ways of funding a war is through bonds, mm-hmm, war bonds, and convincing the people back home to support the war.
Yep.
Well, in a sense, supporting the war on the state is not necessarily going out blowing things up or getting yourself arrested for some people. For some people, it's picking out an organization like Mises.org or the Fully Informed Jury or the Free State Project and sending them a couple bucks.
Mm-hmm.
You don't break your bank account, but if you send them a dollar or two,
sharing a link on your Facebook page.
Sure, anything like that that you can do. And you know, there are different ones of us at different stages of development in the liberty movement. And a lot of times we're surrounded by family members who don't necessarily understand or accept these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of have to be that undercover libertarian. And you can't really come out, you know, it's like you're hiding in the closet. You can't really come out of the closet and go, mm-hmm, I'm a libertarian.
Yeah.
Because they will not understand it. They will not accept it. You will be ostracized.
Yep.
They will beat you down until you admit you're not a libertarian.
And saying you're an anarchist is even worse.
Yeah.
Because libertarian, whether you're a libertarian who aligns themselves with the actual Libertarian Party or not, in a lot of people's minds, being a libertarian is a little bit more socially acceptable because there is an actual political party associated with it.
Yeah.
Saying that you're an anarchist,
they translate that into a nut. You're a nut.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me touch on this for a second. You know, I've seen, I don't know how many times this has happened, I've said, well, I'm an anarcho-capitalist. Well, what is that? Well, you know, I support anarchy, capitalistic anarchy. And the person in response will be, well, the Webster's Dictionary defines anarchy as being when everyone wants to kill each other, you know, or some ridiculous thing like that. And you think, now, honestly, I've known this person for years. Do they really think that I want slaughter in the streets mm-hmm. and piles of bodies and burning dumpsters? Do they really think I want that?
Right.
Is this how shallow our...
Or do they really think that I'm so stupid mm-hmm. that I don't know that that's what the dictionary says?
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, really? That's what the dictionary says? Well, that's it. I'm turning around my I'm going to be a Democrat.
Right. And capitalist is almost as bad to say.
Yeah. Yeah, because they put this image in their mind that is entirely not capitalism. Yeah.
They see, oh, you're a capitalist, and they view the, you know, the little guy from the Monopoly game with the top hat and the monocle, and they're, oh, you're all for, you know, slave factory labor.
You want to destroy the environment.
Yeah.
Oh, man. You know, speaking of destroying the environment, I was having a discussion with somebody... Oh, a couple days ago. What was that about? The free market use of property, and what would happen if there was no government to protect people's land, and there was no if the government wasn't there to preserve millions of acres to keep the nasty industrialists from intentionally polluting it. You know, like BP would just go out there in the Great Plains and dump oil all over everything if they got the chance. And, you know, where our conversation finally ended up was, first off, there are private organizations that take collections and then they go purchase land.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually privatize land for the purpose of preserving it.
Ducks Unlimited does that.
Ducks Unlimited is a perfect example. That when Ducks Unlimited started, the duck population was drastically falling, and so was the geese population.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how it is in the rest of the country, but in Ohio, there are so many geese walking around, you know, at the right time of the year, it's like...
And they can be vicious, too, yeah. Man.
But that's strictly due to the private activities of organizations like Ducks Unlimited and, mm-hmm. and other organizations, too. The guy I was talking to mentioned an organization that's in Oklahoma that's preserving the prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And they have just done a tremendous job just purchasing prairie mm-hmm. and preserving it.
There's a huge, ranges... Mm-hmm. out in the Midwest where you can go and you pay a fee and you can go hunt on there.
Yeah.
They do like wild boar hunting and, you know, all of this sort of stuff.
That's real popular in Texas.
Yeah. And these organizations, these companies, keep this land in good condition.
Mm-hmm.
They keep their population of the animals that they're hunting up because if they don't have the animal, you can't sell the money. You can't.
It's an asset.
Yeah, it's just like stock. That's their product. You know.
Yeah, this is the thing. Well, let's take it into this. This is the thing about forestry and mm-hmm. forest management.
You hear. Forest logging is the prime example. People say
the demons
all the time,
of the logging industry.
I can't even count how many times I've heard people go, well, if it weren't for the government, logging companies would just log all across Yellowstone and there'd be no national parks.
The problem with the logging industry is the socialization of land mm-hmm. and the ignoring of the proper property rights in the West.
Yep.
Where you have private property and where a logging company owns private property, they have a vested interest in protecting that private property and making it produce for more than one harvest.
Right.
This is like if there was a farmer who owned a field and he planted corn in it, and then at the end of the corn harvest, he went in and entirely destroyed the field to get his corn harvest out.
Right.
Well, then what's he going to do next year?
Right.
So the timber industry is the same way. If they're only harvesting on private property that they own, they take care of it. They reseed, they replant, They maintain it. They don't let...
They do crop rotation.
Yeah. They put
it
a diversity...
It is a tree farm.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, when you have, quote, government land, which in itself is a violation of property rights principles, mm-hmm. when you have government land, and then the government joins arms with the private industry and with a corporation, and they, in this ungodly marriage, they go out and just blindly harvest public land. That's fascism. Okay? That's fascism. That is not capitalism.
Yes.
When you have a corporate and government marriage to accomplish a deed, that's fascism. And so that's what we see in the Northwest. We have so-called government land, which in itself is a violation of property rights. And the government then issues the right to, and I shouldn't even use the word right, but that's their word.
The privilege.
The privilege. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a privilege. The privilege to a specific monopoly company that goes out and just shreds a whole section of public land. That's fascism.
And we're not calling it fascism because we don't like it or because, you know, yeah. oh, we want to demonize it. That is literally the definition of fascism.
Yeah. When BP wants to drill for oil, we'll use the demonic BP.
The reason why capitalism can't exist, BP.
That's British Petroleum, yeah. by the way. That is fascism. But when BP decides they want to drill a well, they don't go and buy a piece of land and then drill a well on that land and suffer the consequences if they damage that land.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they get a lease from a government.
Yep.
That's fascism.
Yep.
They get a lease from a government. The government doesn't own the land. The government just decided it owns the land. It didn't do anything to in the Lockean sense, to show that it actually owns the land. It just decided it does, and it does because if you don't agree with it, they'll arrest you and kill you.
Yep.
So, you know, what do you expect BP to do? They're going to utilize that as much as possible with as little investment as possible, and if damages are a result, that's business.
Yep.
Now, that wouldn't happen if it was private, but it's not private. BP is not a private company, and they're drilling on land or water that's not privately owned.
Yep.
Therefore, pollution and destruction of the environment is almost guaranteed.
Yep.
Whereas, if there were no corporations, corporations exist solely because the state creates the opportunity for them.
Mm-hmm.
The state creates corporations, and corporations support the state. You think, oh, well, if it weren't for the government, corporations would overrun everything. No, look at what makes a corporation what it is.
Mm-hmm.
A corporation exists because of the state, not the other way around. Anyway, now I'm ranting. Man, you know,
it gets very frustrating because you hear all the time, you know, people throw out these, oh, well, see, that's why capitalism fails. And it's like that. That is not capitalism.
Right.
That is fascism.
Yeah.
That is why fascism fails.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. And then you come along, and, well, then there should be another word. You should get another word instead of capitalism. It doesn't matter. We could call it bunny hops.
Yeah.
We could call it anything you want to call it. And the state and the supporters of the state would pervert that word and make it into something bad.
Yep.
And this is why I was having this discussion with someone, trying to explain to them about fascism and how economics works. And they said, well, you shouldn't call it fascism because that word has been twisted by associating it with Nazis. Well, that's not my fault.
Yeah.
That's the Nazis' fault, and it's not. I don't have any responsibility in that. The fact is, fascism is fascism. Communism is communism, socialism is socialism, and free market capitalism is free market capitalism.
Yep.
And to call it something else because someone else abused that word, they'll just pick another word to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we libertarians used to be called liberals. In the 1800s, libertarians were liberals. But communists took over that word. So now if you say someone is a liberal, what you're actually talking about is a socialist or a communist,
mm-hmm.
or a so-called progressive. What are they progressing towards? Socialism.
Yep.
So they stole that word. So we gave up the word liberal. Now we're libertarian. Well, if you make libertarians out to be baby eaters, what are we going to call ourselves then?
Yeah.
Oh, we can't call ourselves libertarians because they eat babies. Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
Why don't we stand up and say, no, anarchy does not mean chaos. Anarchy does not mean someone's going to bust through your door and kill you and no one will help you. That is not anarchy. That's the lie the state tells you anarchy is. Anarchy is not, we have no roads, we can't drive. No, that's the lie states tell you.
And that kind of brings us to this point where, you know, there are a lot of people who are minarchists, and that's, you know, they have they want a smaller state, they want a contained state. And they almost always, when you start talking to them, they have a thing. They have this one thing that they can understand that the state needs to go away on all these other accounts, but not this.
It's their teddy bear, their security blanket, their
security
pacifier.
Blanket. Yeah. And that could be, you know, roads, it could be national defense, it could be
police,
it could be fire departments.
Air traffic control.
Yeah. Everybody has this thing. This thing that they say, well, I can trust the free market to do everything else, but not this.
Yeah, and really, it is a pacifier. It is that thing that the little kid holds on to. That's the last remnant of being a child that they just don't want to let go of, and they really want to be a grown up. And I'm not saying minarchists are childish. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just making a comparison to how a child will cling to something, and they know in their mind, eventually I got to let go of this.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't want to cross that path. I'll tell you what else it's like. I remember vividly, I'm half a century old, and I remember vividly having to let go of the electric horse at the store. When it just became a time when I was too big for the electric horse, and I just couldn't justify riding it anymore. And I remembered how much fun I had as a little kid riding that little horse, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there just came a time when I just couldn't ask Mom for another... Well, I think it was a quarter by that time, but I remember when they were a dime. But I couldn't justify asking for a quarter any longer to get on that because I was just too big. But I could remember how much fun it was, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what happens sometimes with people. They want to cling to a part of the state. But what you really have to ask yourself is, it's not, can the state do X? Or how will the state do X? Or the state... I'm sorry. I'm saying that backwards. Kai's looking at me like I just grew a horn out of the middle of my forehead. The question is not how will the free market provide X? Or how will the free market assure me my safety? Or assure me that there's roads? Or assure that we have safe travel? Or whatever. That's not the question. The question is, if I have my choice of trusting a system that's based on theft, aggression, and lies, or if I have my choice of a system that's based on voluntarism and law, then which would I choose?
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, the state is not based on law.
Mm-hmm.
The state has no concept of law.
Yep.
The state cannot enforce law. It's incapable of enforcing law. And I think anybody who really gets to know what's going on in the world within states can see that the states enforce the exact opposite of law.
Right.
So how can the states provide justice and law when the state itself is incapable of justice and law?
Yep.
If the state could provide law, it would arrest all the employees of the state for theft.
Right. And it's hard because, you know, so many people say, well, you know, if we could just get back to the old times.
Yeah.
You know, there's this fallacy that people think, well, if we could just get back to the Constitution, it'd be okay.
Or everything
keep it under control.
Everything was fine before they passed before the Federal Reserve came in, or before there was income tax. Where everything was fine before before Wilson got us involved in World War One, or before before the Spanish-American War. We were fine before the Spanish-American War, but actually, when the first president, Washington, was elected, and he happened to be the largest distiller in the newly formed nation. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that happened was a law was passed taxing who? Alcohol producers.
Yep.
Now, how would the president of the newly formed nation support a law saying that alcohol producers have to be taxed when he's the largest alcohol producer in the nation? You say, well, that doesn't make any sense. No, it makes exactly perfect sense, because that's fascism.
Yep.
Abraham Lincoln was too. But George Washington, in an act of fascism, pushed through the whiskey tax, taxing himself, knowing that his operation could handle the tax, but it would be a crushing blow to all his competition.
Yep.
Then he used the military of this newly formed country to go and enforce this tax upon people who had never had tax upon their alcohol production before.
Mm-hmm.
So you could literally have people living in Appalachia who were producing alcohol as their primary means of living.
Yep.
And they had never in their entire life been taxed. And now there's this revolution, a secession.
These East Coasters,
yeah,
have this secession.
Yeah, that the Appalachians had nothing to do with.
Force this secession upon the Appalachians.
Yeah.
And they take Appalachia. They don't, there was no, hey guys, do you want to join us?
Appalachia didn't vote.
Yeah.
There was no vote. My forefathers, we had no say in the Continental Congress. None. Mm-hmm. We were entirely not represented. And yet, they just swallowed us anyway.
Yep.
And then they decide to tax us with their liquor tax. And that's where the Whiskey Rebellion came from.
Yep.
Now, I'll give George Washington credit. I've written this before and I've said it numerous times. George Washington was smart enough that when he decided to march his army into Pennsylvania to enforce the alcohol tax, the whiskey tax, he was smart enough that he did not go through Appalachia. He went around through the low country and came up the sort of the back way into mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. Because had he marched his army across Appalachia, he never would have made it to Pennsylvania.
No. Appalachia took out the British army.
Yeah.
When the British army tried to march through Appalachia.
King's Mountain. The state has a huge mythology that they've written about that. But the truth is that a British army attempted a flanking maneuver to get behind Lafayette's army. And in the process, they wandered into Appalachia.
And they trespassed on private lands.
And that is why the Appalachians attacked them.
Yeah, the Appalachians were not participating in the revolution. The Appalachians were simply enforcing their property rights.
Yes. If Lafayette's army had marched through eastern Tennessee, the same fate would have happened to Lafayette and his army.
Mm-hmm.
Or Washington and his army. If you notice, Washington spent the entire war, other than basically two battles, Washington spent the entire war retreating,
mm-hmm.
Doing his best not to get in the battle. If Washington had wandered his military into Appalachia, they would have the war would have been much shorter.
Mm-hmm. So this idea that, if we could just get back to the Constitution, it's not...
Yeah, I kind of wandered there, didn't I?
You know?
I kind of wandered off into Appalachia. I like to rant about Appalachia. Yeah, the Constitution, the minute the Constitution was signed, the Articles of Confederation fell away. And we have this lie that's told to us by state schools, by the socialist schools, that says, oh, well, the Articles of Confederation were a failed government. Well, no, the only way you consider the Articles of Confederation a failed government is if you realize that under the Articles of Confederation, the federal government could never grow and expand and dominate life.
Yep.
Whereas if we get a constitution and we put in it a limited set of things, then we have the formation, we have the structure, the bones
yep.
of an empire.
And, you know, I've pointed out before, going back to the Constitution won't help anything, because if the Constitution had... If the Constitution were capable of controlling the government, it would have controlled the government.
Right.
It clearly can't do that because it hasn't done that.
Yeah, and even in the first presidency, it didn't do that.
Yeah.
The Constitution did not keep Washington from marching on the whiskey producers.
It didn't prevent the War of 1812.
It didn't stop Madison from passing the Alien and Sedition Act, which actually made it out against the law to speak bad against who? Madison.
Right.
There was a guy that was actually arrested for calling Madison, I think he called him a fat little pig or something like that, and he was arrested
yep.
because he called the president a fat little pig or whatever it was. Now, can you imagine that? But that was, what, this was Madison the second president, I think? I can't remember the exact order. No, it was Washington, then Adams. Sure. Maybe it was Adams that passed that. I think it was Adams, because Jefferson was his vice president. I'm
yeah.
saying Madison, but that's... I'm sorry, dead Madison. I didn't mean to. That was Adams. That was John Adams. Because Jefferson was his vice president,
mm-hmm.
and Jefferson was so afraid of the Alien and Sedition Act that he was afraid to write letters because they would confiscate the letters in transit. Now, keep in mind... This is like the, what's the current thing now where they just come in and check your email and Homeland Security.
Yeah, Homeland Security.
This is the terrors of Homeland Security that were inflicted upon Thomas Jefferson, who was the vice president at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution didn't stop it.
Yep.
So Jefferson clandestinely had to write Kentucky and Virginia resolutions to try to say, look, the states can stop this. The states can override the Constitution. And it was kind of kicked back and forth whether they could. Well, the ultimate answer to that, and Tom Woods is out there right now. You know, he's got a great book out and everything, and Tom Woods shows how nullification is a part of American history.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that when the nullification becomes serious, the federal government will just say, we opt out.
Yeah.
We're not going to let you nullify that.
Yep.
And if you don't believe me, ask the people in California who are being arrested for medical marijuana right now.
Yep.
Ask the dying guy in the wheelchair with cancer how come he's looking at the rest of his life in prison because he legally bought marijuana for medical purposes.
Ask the Amish farmer who takes raw milk from one state where it's legal to another state where it's legal.
And the federal government gets involved anyway.
Yep.
So nullification is a great theory, and I appreciate Tom Woods bringing the light to it that he has done. But the fact of the matter is, when you're dealing with the state, you're not talking about somebody who plays fair.
Yeah.
They are not going to ever play by the rules.
Yep.
So if they're not going to ever play by the rules, how is sitting down and writing new rules going to solve anything? Or how is, well, you're not playing by the rules, let's get back to the rules. Okay, so the state says, okay, we'll get back to the rules. And then they go right back to what they were doing.
Right, because the rules were never legitimate to begin with.
No, and, I was going to start reading the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights to show how ridiculous some of them are, but... If you just consider, let me take the Fifth Amendment. Let me just read the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Okay, so we're told the Fifth Amendment guarantees that you don't have to witness against yourself, that you can't be tried for the same thing twice, that your possessions can't be taken, quote, without, what did it say, just compensation? Just compensation? Who decides that?
The state.
Of course. So how could it possibly be just compensation? And there's so many disclaimers in that one Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on the presentment of an indictment of a grand jury. And then it doesn't describe what a grand jury is.
Or what an infamous crime is.
Or what an infamous crime is. Or presentment of an indictment. It doesn't explain what an indictment is. Now you can say, well, those things are already established in law. This was the foundational document of our government.
Mm-hmm.
This is the foundational document. Anything prior to this is going to be superseded by this.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no definition to what this is.
Yep.
And I'm sorry, people say, well, the Bill of Rights was written in plain language. That's not plain language.
No.
Now, if you would say something like, you cannot be questioned about your own activity, but instead we see, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Well, then shouldn't that mean that if I write something, then because I am the author of that, that can't be used against me?
Mm-hmm.
And yet emails are used all the time as evidence against people.
Yep.
Written things are used all the time.
Video.
Video that a person shoots themselves. So, and you say, well, there was no video and there was no email. It doesn't matter. There was handwriting back then.
Yep.
And even at the writing of this, you could be arrested for what you wrote.
Yep.
The First Amendment says very clearly, Congress, Congress shall make no law restricting an establishment of religion or prohibition or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. And yet, there's Jefferson, who right off the bat can't send a letter to somebody because he's afraid of getting arrested.
Yep.
So clearly this thing didn't do what it was designed to do, or what we were told it was designed to do.
Yep.
Perhaps it did exactly what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
Ah. Rant and rant and rant.
So, I mean, you know, you just have to keep that in mind when all of these people, you know, and I like Ron Paul, but he falls into this same trap of thinking, you know, if we could just get rid of this one thing, if we could just get back to the way we were before... No, we were flawed from the beginning.
A state is never going to produce a good result.
No.
The existence of a state, the state itself, is a socialist entity. It is based on the concept that the individual is not the source of the individual's rights.
Mm-hmm.
That the collective group of people is somehow has rights over the individual, so the individual has to conform to their, tax support,
mm-hmm.
and relinquish their right to defend themselves, so that the government can defend them. You know, can do the defense. When a person no longer has the ability to own their own property, if you're being taxed, you don't own that property.
Yep.
And we don't own our property in the U.S. The government can come in at any time and take any piece of property you own or tax anything you own or anything you buy.
Or come onto your property.
They can come onto your property. They make up the what is probable cause. They decide whether or not there's a reason they can come on your property. So, in essence, we have no private property.
Mm-hmm.
We have no private ownership. That being the case, we are not free individuals,
yep.
as long as the state exists.
Yep.
So even the state in its most restricted form must have the ability to forcibly tax and to forcibly extract those taxes
yep.
through use of violence. it cannot allow anybody else to have the ability to use violence, because if it does, somebody will just knock off the government.
Yep.
So it requires a monopoly of violence and the ability to tax.
Yep.
Well, if you have a state with a monopoly on violence and the ability to tax, then what could you possibly do to keep it from growing out of control?
Right. Nothing.
It will always grow out of control. It doesn't matter what magic words you write on a paper.
Yep. It doesn't, you know, it's like buying that little puppy, you know? Yeah, it's tiny right now. Mm-hmm. Look at his paws. It's going to get huge.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do to stop that.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, state begets state. So just like, you know, an apple tree produces an apple tree, and wheat produces wheat, and lions produce lions. The state produces a state. So if you, if a state gets too big, in Jefferson's mind, we need a revolution every now and then to keep the state in line. No, the state produces another state.
Mm-hmm.
So when you rebel against a state, what you're actually just going to do is replace it with a nastier state.
Yep.
It's a cycle that is never going to produce freedom. So state is not the answer. Constitution is not the answer. Revolution is not the answer. Privately separating yourself and becoming independent on as many things as you possibly can is the answer.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, very quickly, because I'm sure we're running out of time.
We are, yes.
But very quickly, I wanted to point out, along this lines, people, you know, bumper stickers all over the, oh, you can't take my guns, I have a constitutional right to have them. You are saying that you were given a right by the state. If you are accepting that the state has given you that right, then the state has the right to take it away.
Right.
If you're saying, I have property rights as a natural law because I am a human. Mm-hmm. I am not given those rights by any other human. They are my natural law.
Mm-hmm.
Then you cannot have that taken away by the state.
Right.
Natural law can only come from outside of humans.
Right.
You know, I can't give you a right.
Right.
That's not how rights work.
Exactly. You have the right because you exist.
Right.
Not because someone gave it to you as a gift or a privilege. Well, we probably did go over time again. You know, I guess what we could just do is start saying, well, it's a 45-minute podcast. Then we'd be a 50-minute podcast.
And then we'd
be you can't restrict these things. They just get out of control. Oh, boy. Okay. Well, anyway, check out the website, badquaker.com. Leave us some feedback. Give us some email. Send us some email. Badquaker@badquaker.com is the admin's email address. My email address is ben@badquaker.com. And
I think I'm Kai.
Kai@badquaker.com. Okay. And send us an email. Tell us, you know, what you think, or suggestions for future episodes. Until the next time, thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm,
thanks
mm-hmm.
for listening to especially my long-winded rant. But
and if you like us, you know, share the link on Facebook, Twitter, any other of the umpteen million social networking sites that you visit. You know.
Yep. Say our name, and thank you very much for listening. BadQuaker.com audio article for Monday, June 27th, 2011. Warriors, Longhairs, Quakers, and Roundheads, Part 1, by Ben Stone. The Warrior and the Longhair. Hair. The odds are, whether you realize it or not, it's likely the first thing you'll notice when you meet a man for the first time. You'll remember if he's bald, has a comb-over, is clean-cut, or unkept. You'll remember if he's bearded, has a mustache, wears sideburns, or is clean-shaven. Hair will be the first thing you judge when forming that first impression. And whether you like it or not, that initial judgment will almost certainly be based on social norms dictated to you by the culture that you were raised in. In America, even the very terminology we use prejudices our thoughts on the matter. If we meet a man who's clean cut and clean shaven, do we assume he would be dirty had he not scraped his face with a blade that morning and visited the barber last week? Is the man who visits the barber every month cleaner by default than the man who doesn't? Of course not. But as we leave these phrases in our day-to-day lexicon, we enforce this myth of the dirty, lazy, hairy man, both to others and to ourselves. I spent years working jobs where, either for safety reasons or for social reasons, I was forced to scrape all of or most of the hair from my face and maintain short cranial hair. When the time came in my life that I was free of such burdens, I stopped hacking at myself and allowed my head to take its natural shape. By doing so, I learned a lot about American culture that I had never noticed before. People reacted to me in ways that I had never experienced. Some people are openly offended by my appearance. Some appear shocked, and some actually draw back as if they may catch something from me. Others show fright, while some just seem very uncomfortable. But, as is often the case, the most natural reaction comes from children and very old men. On a number of occasions, while shopping with my wife, children have run up to me with big smiles as if expecting me to know them by their name. Once a little girl, separated from her mother and wandering scared in a store, walked past my wife and actually came right up and took me by the hand with such trust you would think I was in a fireman's uniform. One may be able to explain it as some kind of Santa Claus-related incident, but I don't really look much at all like Santa, more like a really big Charles Manson. But I think the reaction that surprised me most was from the really old men. They get a childlike smile, and if wearing a hat, they actually tip it in a friendly, respectful gesture. This dramatic difference in behavior caused me to step back and consider exactly what is going on that I was observing. I came to the conclusion that the feelings the children and the old childlike men were expressing were ancient instinctual leftovers from the days when the alpha male was a large, hairy man with a big, graying beard and a mane of hair for a halo. In those days, such a man would have been the primary protector of a village or a clan. The wise old decision-maker for such a tribe may have been an elderly, gray-haired woman or an old, balding man, but the hero, the protector, would have stood out like the silverback in a troop of gorillas. If we accept this assessment of the reaction of the children and the old men, what would explain the reaction of everyone else? On this, I have two thoughts. The first is the development of Western culture that I will speak on later. But the other thought goes back to those ancient instincts. Our love and hate of warriors. First, let me point out that warriors of today are far different physically from warriors that were around as our instincts were developing. Although I fit the physical pattern for a prime warrior of the Stone Age, on a modern battlefield I wouldn't last the first day. Now that said, humans express odd, contradictive feelings towards warriors. The very young and the very old idolize them, but no matter the lip service paid, middle-aged people distrust warriors. Oh, don't get me wrong, middle-aged people love the military folks and will put out great effort to, quote, support the troops. They may give money to a cause, volunteer their time, or pay stickers on their SUVs. But often these outward displays can only partly hide the distrust. Husbands are sexually insecure around warriors because they quietly fear the warrior may steal their wife or their young daughter. The mother has a similar illogical fear for her children. She may feel the warrior could entice her daughter, or she may worry her son may grow up to go off to war, never to return. But the helpless in society, those with pure open hearts and minds not cluttered with the day-to-day hustle, look up at the warrior with loving eyes and trust because it has always been the warrior who looks out for them when everything else in life fails them. Culture. I'll cover this topic with more information in the upcoming sections on Quakers and Roundheads, but for now, I do need to point out a couple thoughts. In many ancient cultures, some kind of slavery, servitude, or caste system existed. Specifically, in cultures dominated by a state, male hair often played an important part in identifying slaves and the subservient. Oftentimes, only free men were allowed to be armed and sport beards and/or uncut cranial hair. Slaves were forced to shave and be shorn so that they could be quickly identified. In many early states, the public cutting of a free man's hair was a punishment meant to publicly humiliate him for an infraction or offense against the state. Oddly enough, in many states, public haircutting was the punishment for crimes that fell one notch short of castration, keeping in mind that male house slaves were often castrated in those days. Rome stands out in history as an exception to the above. Rome began as a subservient culture to their Etruscan neighbors, and therefore all Roman men were shaved and shorn from the earliest days. Once Rome came into its fullness, in a very real sense, all Romans were servants of the state. In a way, it was the first proto-modern state. I could say a lot more about Rome and male hair, but for now, I've made the point that I wanted to cover. In a very real way, America is the resurrected Rome. Like it or not, every man in America is the property of the state. The American today owns no property, no possession that the state cannot take away at any time with the simple power of a slip of paper. Deep inside, this knowledge grinds at the spirit of the American male, but he submits. He keeps his eyes to the ground and he pulls his load. On the rare occasion that something catches his eye and he looks up to see a man with a beard and/or a full cranial hair, resentment quickly flares in direct proportion to the amount of hair displayed. How dare this barbarian, this wild warrior, strut around displaying his freedom when we toil and cringe under our master's whip? For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.